Without releasing his hands, she sat down by his bed on a chair on which his clothes were lying ready.
How do you dress without me? How do you...
She tried to speak simply and cheerfully, but could not, and turned away again.
I don't wash with cold water. Papa says I mustn't. You have not seen Vasily Lukitch? He will come presently. And you're sitting on my clothes!
And Tseretse burst out laughing. She looked at him and smiled.
Mama! Dearest! Darling!
He shouted again, throwing himself upon her and embracing her, as if he only now, having seen her smile, clearly realized what had happened.
You don't want that,
he said, taking off her bonnet. And on seeing her without it, he began kissing her again, as though he had only just seen her.
Well, and what did you think about me? You did not think I was dead? I never believed it! You didn't believe it, my darling. I knew!
He cried, repeating his favourite phrase, and seizing her hand, which was caressing his hair, he pressed her palm to his mouth, covering it with kisses. Chapter 30. Meanwhile, Vasily Lukitch, who had not at first understood who the lady was, having realized from what he heard that she was the mother who had left her husband and whom he, having come to the house only after she had left it, had never seen, hesitated whether to go in or not, or whether to tell Karenin. Having at last concluded that his duty was to get Tseretse up at the appointed time, and that therefore he need not consider who was sitting there, the boy's mother or anyone else, but that he must do his duty, he dressed, went up to the door, and opened it. But the caresses of the mother and son, the sound of their voices and what they were saying, made him change his mind. He shook his head, sighed, and closed the door again.
I will wait another 10 minutes, he said to himself, coughing and wiping away his tears.
Meanwhile, among the servants, there was great commotion. They all knew that the mistress had come, that Kapitonich had admitted her, and that she was now in the nursery. But the master always went to the nursery before 9, and they all understood that a meeting between him and his wife was inconceivable and must be prevented. Corneille, the valet, went down into the hall porter's room to inquire who had let her in, and hearing that it was Kapitonich who had done so, he reprimanded the old man. The hall porter remained obstinately silent. But when the valet said he ought to get the sack, Kapitonich rushed at Corneille, and flourishing his hands about before Corneille's face, began to speak out.
Yes, I dare say you would not have let her in. I've been in service here 10 years, and have had nothing but kindness. You'd better go up and tell her. You be off, please. You're an artful one, you are. You'd better look after yourself, and how to fleece the master of fur coats.
"Soldier," said Corneille contemptuously, and turned to the nurse who had just entered. "Now, judge for yourself, Maria Yefimovna," he said to her. "He's let her in without telling anybody. And Alexei Alexandrovich will be ready in a minute and will go to the nursery."
"Dear, dear, what a business," said the nurse. "You must detain him somehow, Corneille Vasilich, the master, I mean, and I'll run and get her out of the way. What a business!"
When the nurse entered, Tseretse was just telling his mother how he and Nadyenka fell down together when ice-hilling and turned 3 somersaults. She was listening to the sound of his voice, saw his face and the play of his features, felt his hands, but did not understand what he was saying.
She must go away,
must leave him. That was all she thought and felt. She heard Vasily Lukitch's step as he came to the door and coughed, and then the steps of the nurse as she entered. But she sat as if turned to stone, powerless to speak or rise.
"Madam, dear,"
the nurse began, coming up to Anna and kissing her hands and shoulders.
"What joy God has sent our little one on his birthday!
And you have not changed at all.
Oh, nurse dear, I did not know you were in the house, said Anna, rousing herself for a moment.
I don't live here. I live with my daughter, and have only come to wish him many happy returns, Anna Arkadyevna, dear.
Suddenly the nurse burst into tears, and again began to kiss Anna's hand. Seretse, with bright eyes and beaming smile, holding his mother with one hand and his nurse with the other, jumped with his plump, bare feet onto the carpet. The tenderness of his beloved nurse for his mother sent him into raptures.
"Mama, she often comes to see me, and when she comes," he began, but stopped,
noticing that his nurse was whispering something in his mother's ear, and that a look of fear and of something like shame that did not at all suit her face appeared there. She came up to him and said,
"My darling."
She could not say goodbye, but the expression of her face said it, and he understood.
"Darling, darling Kutik,"
she said, calling him by the pet name she used when he was quite little.
"You won't forget me. You..."
But she could say no more. How many things she thought of later that she might have said. But now she did not know what to say and could not speak. But Seretse understood all she wanted to tell him. He understood that she was unhappy and that she loved him. He had even understood what the nurse had said in a whisper. He had caught the words, "always before 9 o'clock," and he understood that they referred to his father and that his mother and father must not meet. This he had grasped. But he could not make out why that look of fear and shame appeared on her face. She could not have done wrong, and yet seemed afraid and ashamed of something. He wanted to ask a question which would clear up his doubts, but dared not. He saw that she suffered, and he was sorry for her. He pressed against her in silence, and then whispered,
"Don't go. He is not coming yet."
His mother moved him away from her to see whether he really believed what he was saying, and in the frightened look on his face, she saw not only that he was speaking about his father, but that he was, as it were, asking her what he ought to think of him.
"Seretse, my darling," she said, "love him. He is better and kinder than I am, and I am to blame toward him. When you are grown up, you will be able to judge."
"There is nobody better than you,"
he cried out in desperation through his tears, and seizing her by her shoulders, he hugged her with all his might, his arms trembling with the effort.
"Darling little one,"
said Anna, and began to cry in the same weak and childlike way as he. At that moment the door opened, and Vasily Lukitch entered. Steps were heard approaching the other door, and a nurse said in a frightened whisper,
"Coming,"
and handed Anna her bonnet. Seretse sank down on his bed and began to sob, hiding his face in his hands. Anna moved the hands away, kissed him again on his wet face, and went rapidly out. Karenin was advancing toward her. When he saw her, he stopped and bowed his head. Despite what she had just said, that he was better and kinder than she was, after casting at him a rapid glance which took in his whole figure to the minutest detail, she was seized by a feeling of loathing and anger toward him, and of jealousy for her son. She swiftly let down her veil, and with quickened steps almost ran out of the room. She had not had time even to unwrap the toys she had chosen with so much love and sadness the day before, and she took them back with her. Chapter 31. Greatly as Anna had desired to see her son, and long as she had thought of and prepared herself for the interview, She had not at all expected that it would affect her so powerfully. On returning to her lonely suite in the hotel, she could not for a long time understand why she was there.
"Yes, it is all ended. And I am alone again," she said to herself.
And without taking off her bonnet, she sat down in an easy chair by the fireplace. With her eyes fixed on a bronze clock standing on a table between the windows, she began pondering. The French maid, whom she had brought from abroad, came and asked whether she would not dress. She looked at her in astonishment and replied,
"Later."
A waiter offered her coffee.
"Later," she said.
The Italian nurse, having smartened up the baby girl, came in and held her out to Anna. The plump, well-nourished baby, as usual when she saw her mother, turned her little hands, so fat that they looked as if the wrists had threads tied tightly round them, palms downward, and, smiling with her toothless mouth, began waving them as a fish moves its fins, making the starched folds of her embroidered frock rustle. It was impossible not to smile, not to kiss the little thing. Impossible not to hold out a finger to her, which she caught, screaming and wriggling the whole surface of her little body. Impossible not to approach one's lips to her mouth and let her draw them in, her way of kissing. And Anna did all these things. She took her in her arms, dandled her, and kissed her fresh cheek and bare elbows. But at the sight of this child, she realized still more clearly that what she felt for her could not even be called love in comparison with her feeling for Seretse. Everything about this baby was sweet, but for some reason she did not grip the heart. Upon the first child, though by an unloved man, all Anna's unsatisfied capacity for loving was lavished. But the girl was born under most trying conditions and had not received a hundredth part of the care given to the first child. Besides, everything about the baby was still prospective, while Seretse was already an individual and a beloved one. Thoughts and feelings struggling in his mind, he understood and loved and judged her, she thought, recalling his words and looks. And from him she was forever sundered. Not only physically, but spiritually. And there was no remedy for it. She returned the baby to its nurse, sent them away, and opened a locket with Seretse's portrait as a baby about the same age as the little girl. Rising, she removed her bonnet and took from the table an album in which were photographs of her son at different ages. She wanted to compare these likenesses and began drawing them out of the album. She took them all out but one, the last and best of the photographs. He was there in a white shirt astride a chair, his brows frowning while his mouth smiled. This was his most characteristic and best expression. She caught hold of a corner of this photo several times with her deft little hand, the slender white fingers of which moved with special strenuousness that day, but each time they slipped and she could not get the picture out. There was no knife on the table, and she drew out the photo next to it, one taken in Rome of Vronsky with long hair and wearing a round hat, and with it pushed out her son's photo.
"Yes, there he is," she said with a glance at Vronsky's likeness, and suddenly remembered that he was the cause of her present grief.
She had not called him to mind all that morning. But now, having caught sight of that manly, noble face, so familiar and dear to her, she felt an unexpected flow of love toward him.
"But where is he? How can he leave me alone in my anguish?" she suddenly thought with a sense of reproach,
forgetting that she herself had hidden from him all that concerned her son. She sent to ask him to come up to her at once. She awaited him, thinking with a sinking heart of the words in which she would tell him everything and of the expressions of his love which would comfort her. The servant returned with the reply that he had a visitor, but would come up at once, and wished to know whether he might bring with him Prince Yashvin, who had just arrived in Petersburg.
"So he won't come alone," she thought. "He won't come so that I can tell him everything, but will bring Yashvin."
and suddenly a strange idea crossed her mind. What if he had ceased to love her? Going over in her mind the events of the last few days, she thought she perceived in everything a confirmation of that dreadful thought. In the fact that he had not dined at home the day before, and that he had insisted on having separate apartments while in Petersburg, and that even now he was not coming alone, perhaps to avoid a tête-à-tête with her. But he must tell me. I must know it. If I know it, then I know what I shall do, she told herself, powerless to imagine the position she would find herself in when she was convinced of his indifference. She imagined that he had ceased to love her, and she was almost in despair, which roused in her a feeling of peculiar excitement. She rang for her maid, and going into the dressing room, paid more attention to her toilette than she had done all these days, as if, having ceased to love her, his love might be recalled by her wearing the dress and having her hair done in the style most becoming to her. She heard the bell before she was ready. When she entered the drawing-room, not his eyes, but Yashvin's met hers. Vronsky was examining her son's photos, which she had forgotten on the table, and did not hurry to look at her. "We are acquainted," she said, placing her little hand in the enormous hand of the embarrassed Yashvin, whose confusion did not seem to accord with his huge figure and rough face. "We have been acquainted since last year's races. Let me have them," she added with a rapid movement, taking from Vronsky the photos he was looking at, and glancing at him impressively with glistening eyes. "Were the races good this year? I saw the races on the Corso in Rome instead, but of course you don't care for life abroad," she went on with a pleasant smile. "I know you and know all your tastes, though we have met so seldom."
"I am very sorry to hear it, for my tastes are mostly bad," said Yashvin, biting the left side of his moustache.
After a short talk, noticing that Vronsky looked at the clock, Yashvin asked her whether she would be staying long in Petersburg, and straightening his immense body, picked up his cap.
"Not long, I think," she replied with embarrassment, glancing at Vronsky.
"Then we shall not meet again," said Yashvin, rising.
And then, turning to Vronsky, he asked,
"Where are you dining?"
"Come and dine with me," said Anna resolutely, as if vexed with herself for her embarrassment, yet blushing, as she always did when she revealed her position to a fresh person.
"The dinners here are not good, but at any rate you will see one another. Of all his regimental friends, Alexei liked you best."
"I shall be very pleased," said Yashvin, with a smile which showed Vronsky that he liked Anna very much.
Yashvin bowed and went out. Vronsky remained behind.
"You are going too?" she asked.
"I am late as it is," he answered. "Go on, I shall catch you up in a minute," he shouted to Yashvin.
She took his hand and looked fixedly at him, trying to think of something to say to prevent his leaving her.
"Wait, I have something to tell you," she said.
And raising his short hand, she pressed it to her neck.
"Was it wrong of me to ask him to dinner?"
"You have done very well," he replied, showing his compact row of teeth in a calm smile and kissing her hand.
"Alexei, you have not changed toward me?" she asked, squeezing his hand in both hers. "Alexei, I am in torment here. When are we going?"
"Soon. Very soon. You would hardly believe how trying our life here is to me, too," he said, drawing away his hand.
"Well then, go."
"Go!"
she said in an offended tone, and quickly left him.
Chapter 32. When Vronsky returned, Anna had not yet come home. He was told that soon after he left, a lady came to see her, and they went away together. Her departure, without mentioning where she was going, her prolonged absence, and the fact that she had been away somewhere in the morning without telling him about it, added to her strangely excited look that morning, and the animosity with which, in Yashvin's presence, she had almost snatched her son's photographs out of his hands, made Vronsky reflect. He decided that it was necessary to have an explanation with her, and he waited for her in the drawing room. But Anna did not return alone. She brought with her her old maiden aunt, Princess Oblonskaya. She it was who had been to see Anna that morning, and they had been shopping together. Anna seemed not to notice the worried look of inquiry on Vronsky's face, but chattered gaily about what she had been buying. He saw that something unusual was taking place within her. Her eyes glittered with an expression of strained attention when her look rested on him, and in her speech and motions there was that nervous quickness and grace which, during the first period of their intimacy, had so captivated him, but which now troubled and alarmed him. The table was laid for four. They were all assembled and about to enter the little dining room when Tuskevich arrived with a message for Anna from the Princess Betsy. The princess asked to be excused for not coming to say goodbye. She was not well, but asked Anna to come and see her between 6:30 and 9. Vronsky glanced at Anna when that definite time was mentioned, which showed that care had been taken to prevent her meeting anyone there, but Anna did not seem to observe it. "I'm sorry that between 6:30 and 9 is just the time when I cannot come," she replied with a faint smile.
"The princess will be very sorry."
"And I too."
"I expect you are going to hear Patti," asked Tuskevich.
"Patti, that's an idea. I would go if I could get a box."
"I could get you one," said Tuskevich.
"I should be very, very grateful if you would," replied Anna.
"But won't you stay and dine with us?"
Vronsky slightly shrugged his shoulders. He could not in the least understand what Anna was after. Why had she brought the old princess? Why had she asked Tuskevich to stay to dinner? And, strangest of all, why was she sending him to get her a box for the opera? Was it conceivable that, in her position, she was going to the opera when Patti was to sing, and when all the subscribers, her society acquaintances, would be present? He looked seriously at her, but she answered him with the same provocative glance of high spirits or desperation, the meaning of which he could not make out. At dinner, Anna was aggressively merry, seeming to flirt with both Tuskevich and Yashvin. After dinner, Tuskevich went to get a box, and Yashvin to have a smoke. Vronsky went with Yashvin down to his own rooms, but after sitting with him a while, ran upstairs again. Anna was already dressed in a light silk dress cut low in front and trimmed with velvet, a dress she had had made in Paris, and on her head she wore some rich white lace which outlined her face and set off her brilliant beauty to great advantage.
"You are really going to the theatre?" said he, trying not to look at her.
"Why do you ask in such a frightened way?" she said, again offended because he did not look at her. "Why should I not go?" She appeared not to grasp the meaning of her words.
"Of course there is no reason whatever," he replied with a frown.
"That's just what I say," she answered, purposely ignoring the sarcasm of his tone, and calmly pulling up her long, perfumed glove.
"Anna, for heaven's sake, what has come to you?" he said, trying to recall her to her senses, as her husband once used to do.
"I don't understand your question."
"You know it is out of the question for you to go."
"Why? I'm not going alone. The Princess Barbara has gone to dress and is coming with me."
He shrugged his shoulders with a bewildered and despairing look.
"But don't you know?" he began.
"I don't want to know!"
she almost screamed.
"I don't! Do I repent of what I have done? No, no, no! If it had to begin again from the beginning, I should do just the same, for us, for you and me, Only one thing is important. Whether we love each other. No other considerations exist. Why do we live here, separated and not seeing one another? Why can't I go? I love you, and it's all the same to me, she said, changing from French into Russian, while her eyes, as she looked at him, glittered with a light he could not understand. So long as you have not changed toward me. Why don't you look at me?
He looked at her. He saw all the beauty of her face and of her dress, which suited her as her dresses always did. But now it was just this beauty and elegance that irritated him. My feelings cannot change, you know that. But I beg you not to go. I entreat you, he said, again speaking French with tender entreaty in his voice, but with a cold look in his eyes. She did not hear his words, but saw the coldness of his look and replied irritably, And I beg you will explain why I should not go. Because it might cause you... He became confused. I don't understand you at all. Yashvin n'est pas compromettant, and Princess Barbara is no worse than other people. Ah, here she is. Chapter 33 Vronsky, for the first time, felt vexed and almost angry with Anna for her unwillingness to realize her position. This feeling was strengthened by the fact that he could not tell her the reason of his vexation. Had he told her frankly what he thought, he could have said, To appear dressed as you are at the theater, accompanied by the princess whom everybody knows, means not only to acknowledge your position as a fallen woman, but to throw down a challenge to society, which means to renounce it forever. But he could not say this to her. But how can she fail to understand it? And what is happening to her? He asked himself. He felt that his regard for her had diminished, and his consciousness of her beauty increased simultaneously. He went down, frowning, to his rooms, and taking a seat beside Yashvin, who sat with his long legs stretched out on a chair drinking brandy and seltzer, ordered the same for himself. You were talking about Lankovsky's Powerful. He is a good horse, and I advise you to buy him, said Yashvin, glancing at his comrade's gloomy countenance. It's true he has a goose rump, but his legs and head leave nothing to be desired. I think I'll take him, replied Vronsky. This conversation about horses interested him, but he never forgot Anna, and involuntarily listened to the steps in the corridor and glanced at the clock on the mantelpiece. Anna Arkadyevna sent me to say that she has gone to the theater, said a servant. Yashvin emptied another glass of brandy into the sparkling water, drank it, and then rose, buttoning his coat. Well, let us go, he said, smiling slightly under cover of his big moustache, and showing by that smile that he understood the cause of Vronsky's depression but did not attach importance to it. I'm not going, said Vronsky dismally. Well, I have got to, I promised. Then au revoir. But why not come to the stalls? Take Krasinski's place, Yashvin added as he went out. No, I have something to do. With a wife, one has trouble, but with one who is not a wife, it's worse, thought Yashvin as he left the hotel. Left alone, Vronsky got up and began pacing the room. What is on today? The fourth abonnement. Alexander will be there with his wife, and probably mother also. That's to say, all Petersburg will be there. Now she has gone in, taken off her cloak, and come forward into the light. Tuskevich, Yashvin, the Princess Barbara. He pictured them to himself. And what of me? Am I afraid? Or have I put her under Tuskevich's protection? Whichever way one looks at it, it's a stupid position.
Why does she put me in such a position?
He said with a wave of his arm. As he made this gesture, he struck the little table on which the seltzer and a decanter of brandy were standing and almost knocked it over. In trying to save it from falling, he overturned it and in his vexation kicked it and rang the bell.
If you wish to remain in my service, he said to the valet when the latter came in, remember your duties. There must be none of this sort of thing. You must clear it away.
The valet, conscious that he was not to blame, was about to defend himself, but, glancing at his master, saw by his face that there was nothing for it but to keep silence. So, stooping quickly, he knelt on the carpet and began sorting out the whole and broken glasses and bottles.
That's not your business. Send a waiter to clear it up, and get out my dress suit.
Vronsky entered the theatre at 8:30. The performance was in full swing. The attendant, an old man, helped him off with his overcoat, recognized him, and addressing him as Your Excellency, suggested that he need not take a ticket for his coat, but should merely call for Theodore when he wanted it. There was nobody in the brightly illuminated corridor except the attendant and two footmen, who, with their master's coats over their arms, stood listening outside a door. Through a door slightly ajar came the sounds of a muffled staccato accompaniment by the orchestra, and of a female voice rendering a musical phrase with precision. The door opened to let an attendant slip through, and the nearly completed phrase struck Vronsky's ears distinctly. The door was closed immediately, and he did not hear the end of the phrase, nor the trill after it, but knew from the thunder of applause behind the door that the trill was finished. When he entered the auditorium, brilliantly illuminated by chandeliers and bronze gas brackets, the noise still continued. On the stage, the singer, in a glitter of bare shoulders and diamonds, was bowing low and smiling as she picked up, with the help of the tenor, who held her hand, bouquets that had been clumsily flung across the footlights. She went up to a gentleman with hair shiny with pomatum and parted in the middle, who was stretching his long arms across the footlights to hand her something, and the whole audience in the stalls and in the boxes stirred, leant forward, shouted and applauded. The conductor, from his raised seat, helped to pass the bouquets and rearranged his white tie. Vronsky went to the middle of the floor, then stopped and looked around him. Today he paid less attention than ever to the familiar surroundings, the stage, the noise, and all that well-known, uninteresting, motley herd of audience in the packed theatre. In the boxes sat the same kind of ladies with the same kind of officers behind them, as usual, the same kind of people, heaven only knew who, the same gaily dressed women, uniforms, frock coats, the same dirty crowd in the gallery, and in the whole of that throng, in the boxes and front seats, some 40 real men and women. To these oases, Vronsky at once turned his attention, and immediately got into touch with them. The act had just finished when he came in, so before going to his brother's box, he went up to the front row and paused beside Serpukhovsky, who was standing with his knee bent, tapping the wall of the orchestra with his heel. He had noticed Vronsky afar off and welcomed him with a smile. Vronsky had not yet seen Anna. He intentionally avoided looking her way, but from the direction in which people were looking, he knew where she was. He glanced around unobtrusively, but did not look at her. Prepared for the worst, he looked for Karenin. Luckily for him, Karenin was not in the theatre that evening.
"How little of the military man is left in you," remarked Serpukhovsky. "You might be a diplomatist, an artist, or anything of that kind." "Yes, as soon as I returned home I put on a black coat," Vronsky replied with a smile, slowly taking out his opera glasses.
"Now in that I confess I envy you. I, when I come back from abroad and put this on again, regret my freedom," he said, touching his shoulder knot.
Serpukhovskoy had long ago ceased to trouble himself about Vronsky's career, but was as fond of him as ever, and was particularly amiable to him now.
"A pity you were late for the first act."
Vronsky, listening with one ear, levelled his glasses first at the lower tier and then at the boxes in the dress circle, taking them all in review. Next to a lady wearing a turban and a bald old man who blinked angrily just as Vronsky's moving glass reached him, he suddenly saw Anna's proud head, strikingly beautiful, and smiling in its frame of lace. She was in the fifth box in the lower tier, some 20 paces from him. She sat in the front of the box and, slightly turning back, was saying something to Yashvin. The poise of her head on her fine, broad shoulders and the gleam of restrained excitement in her eyes and her whole face reminded him precisely of how he had seen her at the ball in Moscow. But her beauty affected him very differently now. There was no longer anything mysterious in his feelings for her, and therefore, though her beauty attracted him even more strongly, it also offended him. She was not looking his way, but he felt that she had already seen him. When Vronsky directed his glasses that way again, he noticed that the Princess Barbara was very red, and that she was laughing unnaturally, and looking round incessantly at the next box, while Anna, tapping with her closed fan the red velvet edge of the box, was gazing fixedly somewhere else, not seeing, and evidently not wishing to see what was taking place in the next box. Yashvin's face wore the expression it had when he was losing at cards. He was frowning and drawing the left side of his moustache further and further into his mouth, looking askance at the adjoining box. In that box to the left were the Katasovs. Vronsky knew them, and knew that Anna had been acquainted with them. The wife, a thin little woman, was standing up in her box with her back to Anna, putting on an opera cloak which her husband was holding for her. Her face looked pale and angry, and she was speaking excitedly. Kartasov, a stout, bald-headed man, kept glancing round at Anna while trying to pacify his wife. When the wife left the box, the husband loitered behind, trying to catch Anna's eye and evidently wishing to bow to her. But Anna, with obvious intention, took no notice of him, and, turning round, was saying something to Yashvin, whose cropped head was bent toward her. Kartasov went out without bowing, and the box remained empty. Vronsky could not make out what had taken place between the Kartasovs and Anna, but he saw that it was something humiliating for Anna. He realized that from what he had seen, and especially from Anna's face, who, he knew, was summoning her utmost strength to sustain the role she had undertaken. She fully succeeded in playing that role of external tranquillity. Those who did not know her and her set, and heard none of the expressions of pity, indignation, or surprise uttered by the women because she had allowed herself to appear in public and to show herself so ostentatiously in her lace headdress and in all her beauty, admired the composure and loveliness of the woman, and did not suspect that she felt as though pilloried. Knowing that something had happened, but not knowing just what, Vronsky felt painfully agitated, and, hoping to find out something, set out for his brother's box. Intentionally leaving the auditorium at the opposite side to where Anna was, he encountered the commander of his old regiment, who stood talking to two acquaintances. Vronsky heard them mention the name of Karenin, and noticed how the commander hastened to call him loudly by name with a significant glance at the others.
"Ah, Vronsky! When are you coming to see us at the regiment? We can't let you go away without a feast. You are one of our very own," said the commander.
"I shall not have time. I'm very sorry. Some other time," said Vronsky, and ran up the stairs to his brother's box. In the box was Vronsky's mother, the old countess with her iron-grey curls. Varya and the Princess Sorokina he met in the corridor outside. Having conducted the Princess Sorokina back to Vronsky's mother, Varya held out her hand to her brother-in-law and at once began to talk of the matter that interested him. He had rarely seen her so excited. "I consider it mean and disgusting, and Madame Kartasova had no right to do it. Madame Karenina," she began.
"But what is it? I don't know. Haven't you heard?"
"You know I shall be the last to hear of it."
"Is there a creature more venomous than that Kartasova?
But what has she done? My husband told me. She insulted Madame Karenina. Her husband began conversing with her from his box, and Kartasova flew at him. It seems she said something insulting out loud and then went out.
Count, your maman wants you, said the Princess Sorokina, looking out of the box door. I have been expecting you all the time, said his mother with a sarcastic smile. I never see anything of you. Her son saw that she could not repress a smile of satisfaction.
Good evening, maman. I was coming to you, he replied coldly.
Why don't you go faire la cour à Madame Karenine, she added, when the Princess Sorokina had stepped aside. Elle fait sensation. On oublie la patrie pour elle.
Maman, I asked you not to speak to me about that subject, he answered, frowning.
I am saying what everyone says.
Vronsky did not reply, and after a few words addressed to the Princess Sorokina, he left the box. In the doorway, he met his brother.
Ah, Alexei, said his brother. What a shame. That woman is a fool, that's all. I was just going to see her. Let's go together.
Vronsky did not listen to him. He hurried downstairs, feeling that he must do something. He knew not what. He was disturbed both by vexation with Anna for placing herself and him in this false position, and by pity for her sufferings. He descended to the stalls and went straight to Anna's box, in front of which stood Stremov, talking to her.
There are no more tenors. Le moule en est brisé.
Vronsky bowed to her and stopped to shake hands with Stremov.
I think you got here late and missed the finest aria, said Anna to him, with a mocking glance, as it seemed to him.
I am a poor judge, he replied, looking severely at her.
Like Prince Yashvin, who considers that Patti sings too loud, she returned with a smile. Well, thank you, she said, taking with her small gloved hand a program Vronsky had picked up for her. And suddenly, at that instant, her beautiful face quivered. She rose and went to the back of the box. Noticing that during the next act her box remained empty, Vronsky left the theatre amid cries of hush from the audience, which had become quiet to listen to a cavatina. He went to his hotel. Anna had already returned. When Vronsky entered, she was still dressed as she had been at the theatre. She was sitting in the first armchair by the wall, fixedly gazing before her. She glanced at him and immediately resumed her former posture.
Anna, he said,
it's all your fault. Your fault,
she exclaimed, with tears of despair and spite in her voice, and rose.
But I asked, I entreated you not to go. I knew it would be unpleasant for you.
Unpleasant, she cried.
It was awful. However long I may live, I shall never forget it. She said it was a disgrace to sit near me.
The words of a silly woman, he said.
But why risk it? Why provoke?
I hate your calmness.
You should not have driven me to it.
If you loved me, Anna, is it a question of my love?
Yes. If you loved me as I love you, if you suffered the anguish I do,
she replied, with a frightened glance at him. He was sorry for her, and yet vexed with her. He assured her of his love because he saw that that alone could pacify her now, and did not reproach her with words, though he reproached her in his heart. And those assurances of love, which to him appeared so trivial that he felt ashamed to utter them, she drank in and gradually became calm. Next day, fully reconciled, they left for the country. Part 6.
Chapter 1 Dolly and her children were spending the summer with her sister Kitty at Pokrovsk. The house on her own estate was quite dilapidated, so Levin and his wife persuaded her to spend the summer with them. Oblonsky quite approved of this arrangement. He said he greatly regretted that his duties prevented his spending the summer with his family in the country, which would have given him the greatest pleasure, and he remained in Moscow, visiting the country occasionally for a day or two at a time. Beside the Oblonskys, with all their children and their governess, the Levins had other visitors. The old princess, who considered it her duty to watch over her inexperienced daughter in that condition, and also Varenka, Kitty's friend from abroad, who was keeping her promise to visit her friend now that she was married. All these were relations and friends of Kitty's, and though Levin liked them, he regretted his own, the Levin world and order of things, which was being submerged by this influx of the Shcherbatsky element, as he put it to himself. Only one of his relatives, Sergei Ivanich, visited him that summer, and he was a man of the Koznishev type, and not a Levin, so that the Levin spirit was quite overwhelmed. In the Levin house, so long empty, there were now so many people that nearly every room was occupied, and the old princess was obliged almost daily to count those present before sitting down to a meal. If there chanced to be 13, she would make a grandchild sit at the side table. And Kitty, who conducted her household with great assiduity, had no little trouble to procure all the chickens, turkeys, and ducks, of which, with the visitors and the children's summer appetites, very many were required. The whole family was assembled at dinner. Dolly's children, their governess, and Varenka were planning where they should hunt for mushrooms. Koznishev, who by his intellect and learning commanded a respect almost amounting to veneration from all the visitors, surprised everyone by joining in the conversation about mushrooms. "You must take me, too. I am very fond of looking for mushrooms," he said with a glance at Varenka. "I consider it a very good occupation." "Why, certainly, we shall be very pleased," replied Varenka with a blush. Kitty and Dolly exchanged significant looks. The intellectual and learned Koznishev's offer to go and gather mushrooms with Varenka confirmed a suspicion that had greatly occupied Kitty's mind of late. She hastened to say something to her mother so that her glance should pass unnoticed. After dinner, Koznishev sat down by the drawing-room window, continuing his conversation with his brother over a cup of coffee, and glancing now and then at the door through which the children, who were preparing to set out on the mushroom hunt, would enter. Levin sat down on the windowsill beside his brother. Kitty stood near her husband, evidently waiting for the end of the conversation, which did not interest her, before speaking to him. "In many ways you have changed since your marriage, and for the better," said Koznishev, smiling at Kitty, and apparently not much interested in his conversation with his brother. "But you have remained true to your passion for defending the most paradoxical views." "Kate, it is not good for you to be standing," said her husband with a meaning look, moving a chair toward her. "Ah, well, there's no time now," added Koznishev, as the children came running in. In advance of them all, at a sideways gallop, came Tanya in tightly pulled-up stockings, running toward Koznishev, flourishing a basket and his hat. Having boldly approached him, her beautiful eyes beaming, eyes so like her father's, she gave him his hat and made a movement as if to put it on him, her shy and gentle smile softening the boldness of the action. "Varenka is waiting," she said, carefully placing his hat on his head, when she saw from his smile that she had permission to do so. Varenka, who was wearing a yellow print dress and a white kerchief on her head, stood in the doorway. "I'm coming, Mademoiselle Varenka," said Koznishev, drinking up his coffee and pocketing his handkerchief and cigar case. "What a darling my Varenka is, eh?" Kitty said to her husband as soon as Koznishev had risen. She said it so that the latter could hear, with an evident desire that he should do so. "And how handsome, how nobly handsome." "Varenka," she exclaimed, "you will be in the wood by the mill? We will drive there." "You quite forget your condition, Kitty," said the old princess, hurrying in. "You should not shout so." Varenka, hearing Kitty's voice and her mother reprimanding her, came up with her light step. The quickness of Varenka's movements, the colour suffusing her animated face, all showed that something unusual was taking place within her. Kitty knew what that unusual thing was and watched her attentively. She had now called Varenka only to give her a silent blessing for the important event which, according to Kitty, was to happen in the woods that day after dinner.
"Varenka, I shall be very happy if a certain thing comes to pass," she whispered, kissing her.
"And are you coming with us?" Varenka, quite confused, asked Levin, pretending not to have heard what had been said to her. "I will come, but only as far as the threshing floor. I shall stay there."
"Oh, why should you?" said Kitty.
"I must look at the new wagons and count them," said Levin. "And where will you be?"
"On the balcony."
Chapter 2 All the women of the household were assembled on the balcony. They always liked to sit there after dinner, but today they had special business there. Besides the sewing of little shirts and the knitting of swaddling bands on which they were all engaged, today jam was being made there in a way new to Agafya Mikhailovna, without the addition of water to the fruit. Kitty was introducing this new way, which had been employed in her old home. But Agafya Mikhailovna, to whom this work had formerly been entrusted, and who considered that nothing that used to be done in the Levin house could be wrong, had, despite her directions, put water to the strawberry and the wild strawberry jam, declaring it to be indispensable. She had been detected doing this, and now the raspberry jam was being made in everyone's presence, as Agafya Mikhailovna had to be convinced that without water the jam could turn out well. Agafya Mikhailovna, with a flushed face and a grieved expression, her hair ruffled and her thin arms bared to the elbow, was shaking the preserving pan over the brazier with a circular movement, looking dismally at the raspberries, and hoping with all her heart that they would harden and not get cooked through. The old princess, conscious that against her, as chief advisor in the matter of jam boiling, Agafya Mikhailovna's wrath should be directed, tried to look as if she were thinking of other things and was not interested in the raspberries. She talked of other matters, but watched the brazier out of the corner of her eye. "I always buy dress materials for the maids myself, at the sales," the princess said, continuing the conversation. "Is it not time to take the scum off, my dear?" she added, turning to Agafya Mikhailovna. "It is not at all necessary for you to do it yourself. Besides, it's hot," she said, stopping Kitty.
"I will do it," said Dolly, and she got up and began carefully sliding the spoon over the surface of the bubbling syrup, and now and then, to remove what had stuck to the spoon, she tapped it against a plate already covered with the yellowish pink scum, with blood-red streaks of syrup showing beneath it. "How they'll lick it up at tea-time," she thought of the children, remembering how she herself, when a child, used to marvel that the grown-ups did not eat the scum, the nicest part. "Steva says it's better to give them money," Dolly remarked, returning to the interesting topic of what presents it was best to give to the servants. "But how can one give them money?" said the princess and Kitty with one voice. "They value presents so."
"Well, I, for instance, got our Matryona Semyonovna, not exactly poplin, but something of that kind last year," said the princess. "Yes, I remember she wore it on your name day. The pattern is charming, so simple and refined. I would have had one made like it myself if she hadn't had it. It is something like Varenka's, and so pretty and cheap." "Well, I think it is ready now," said Dolly, dripping syrup from the spoon. "When it begins to string, it is ready. Boil it up a little longer, Agafya Mikhailovna."
"Oh, these flies!" cried Agafya Mikhailovna crossly. "It will come out just the same."
"Oh, how sweet he is! Don't frighten him," exclaimed Kitty unexpectedly, looking at a sparrow that had settled on the railing, turned a raspberry stalk over, and was pecking at it.
"Yes, but keep away from the brazier," said her mother.
Apropos d'Avarenka, said Kitty in French, which they had been talking all the time, so that Agafya Mikhailovna should not understand them. Do you know, Mama, I am somehow expecting it to be settled today. You understand what I mean? How nice it would be.
Dear me, what a skilful matchmaker, teased Dolly. How carefully and adroitly she brings them together.
Oh, come, Mama, tell me what you think about it.
What am I to think?
He meant Koznishev, could have made the best match in Russia any time. Now he is no longer so young, but all the same, I'm sure many would marry him, even now.
She is very good-natured, but he might...
Oh, but, Mama, try and understand why nothing better could be imagined either for him or for her.
First of all, she is simply charming, expostulated Kitty, crooking one finger.
He certainly likes her very much, Dolly chimed in.
Secondly, his position in the world is such that neither property nor the social position of his wife matters to him at all. He only needs a good, sweet, quiet wife.
Yes, one certainly can trust her, again chimed in Dolly.
Thirdly, she must love him, and that too is... In a word, it would be splendid.
I expect when they come back from the wood it will all be settled.
I shall see it at once by their eyes. I should be so glad.
What do you think, Dolly? But don't get excited. There is no need at all for you to get excited, admonished her mother.
But I am not excited, Mama.
I think he will propose today. Ah, how strange it is when and how a man proposes. There is a sort of barrier. And suddenly, down it goes, said Dolly with a dreamy smile, recalling her past with Oblonsky.
Mama, how did Papa propose to you? Kitty suddenly inquired.
There was nothing special about it.
It was quite simple,
answered the princess. But her face brightened at the memory.
No, but how? You really loved him before you were allowed to talk to one another?
Kitty felt a particular charm in being able now to talk with her mother as an equal about those chief events in a woman's life.
Of course he loved me.
He used to visit us in the country.
But how was it decided, Mama?
I suppose you think you discovered something new.
It was just the same.
It was decided by the eyes, by smiles. How well you put it, Mama, by the eyes and by smiles. That's just it, chimed in Dolly.
But what were the words he said?
What words did Constantine say to you?
He wrote with chalk. It was wonderful.
How long ago it seems, she replied. And the three women meditated silently on the same subject. Kitty was the first to break the silence. She recalled the whole of the winter preceding her marriage and her infatuation with Vronsky. There's one thing, that old love affair of Varenka's, she said, following the natural sequence of her thoughts. I wish to tell Koznishev somehow, to prepare him. Men, all of them, are terribly jealous of our pasts.
Not all, said Dolly. You judge by your own husband. He is still tormented by the memory of Vronsky, eh? Am I not right?
You are, answered Kitty, her eyes smiling dreamily.
But I do not know, interposed the princess, defending her maternal watchfulness over her daughter, what there is in your past to trouble him. That Vronsky courted you? Such things happen to every girl.
Oh, but we're not talking about that, said Kitty, blushing.
No, excuse me, her mother continued. And then you yourself would not let me talk it over with Vronsky, don't you remember?
Oh, Mama, said Kitty, looking pained. Nowadays one can't hold you girls in. Your relations with him could not have gone beyond what was proper, else I should have spoken to him myself. However, my love, it won't do for you to get agitated. Please remember that and keep calm.
I am quite calm, Mama.